between the convention center and Hyatt. It's a good way to wake up. Just a quick show of hands, how many would say that you work in the field of mental health? Most of, how about public health? Okay, great. And both. Terrific. Okay, the reason I ask that is that, you know, our experience in screening in the mental health field recently has been a lot more challenging in some ways politically and socially than it has been with typical public health screening. You know, I have a public health background originally, and screening is just one of the parts of things that you do. But, you know, there's been some controversy in recent years around that. So as we talk about the principles of screening and early ID process, that's something, if you're not as familiar with what's happening in the mental health field around that, that I can explain. So as I said, I'm joined by two speakers today, and I'll introduce them. Wendy Holt is from DMA Health Strategies, and she has been working on the guide. The information we're going to share, a lot of the information today, is from a new guide that will be coming out, hopefully. Let's see, this is just about November, so let's hope in the spring. We, working for the federal government, clearance always takes a long time, and this guide is in the very last stage of clearance. But it is a guide in which the first four chapters talk about the early identification process. And then there are sections specific to child welfare, juvenile justice, homeless and domestic shelters, domestic abuse shelters, primary care, early childhood, etc. So each setting has specific resources and information, and we hope that it will be very helpful to a range of different child-serving agencies and organizations. And I'll talk more about that in a little bit. Okay. And then Eric Lulo, feel very honored to have him here. He's going to share the youth perspective, what it's like as a youth going through the systems and needing and sometimes getting, sometimes not getting the early identification process done the right way. And Eric, I feel really honored to work with him. He's been teaching us a lot about what it's really like to understand the needs of youth in the systems. And there are handouts. If you don't have them, there's some piles, and I'll be referring to them. Did everybody get the handouts? They're on the chairs.
People can sign up for
them. Yes, and also, if you'd like a copy of the guide when it comes out, we're going to send a sign-up sheet around. It should also be on our website, which is samhsa.gov/children. May not be done till May, knowing the federal clearance process, but we really think we've been working on this for several years now because it's a cross-agency guide. And those always take a while, but we will send an announcement out to you when it's available. Okay, so let's get started. And I do need to say that there are no relationships to disclose, no conflict of interest. Okay, so we have four objectives for this session. We want to list the approaches that child-serving programs can take to identify youth at high risk for mental health and also substance abuse problems. That's okay, Wendy. We want to describe strategies to effectively partner with providers and caregivers to implement early identification, because we know one of the big issues is the services and supports needed aren't always out there. So how do we make them accessible if we're going to go ahead and identify youth in need of these services and supports? We're going to identify the groups with known risk factors for mental health and substance abuse challenges, and we're going to discuss some appropriate mental health screening tools. This work began, as I said, 5 or 6 years ago when we developed a group of interagency partners called the Federal National Partnership. It's a very long title, for Transforming Child and Family Mental Health and Substance Abuse. And we first met in 2004, and through the work, and you'll see all these agencies, decided to form a sub-work group on early identification. And it's very exciting because if any of you work in the federal government, besides my colleague from SAMHSA, Michael, you'll know that interagency work groups, it's been a challenge for us to not be siloed and to get our work together and to agree on basic principles and procedures. And so this has been a real exciting success in that way, that this is definitely not just a Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, SAMHSA, which is my agency, not just our effort, but it's been the effort of all these agencies together. And you'll notice CDC is in there, very much a public health approach, which is, you know, is not the traditional way we go in mental health and is now the new way that we're really trying to look at mental health from a public health approach. I remember right after 9/11, I was at the APHA. Were any of you there then? And I needed to do a session for a colleague of mine who was at Ground Zero. And I came to APHA and did one on the 2000 health objectives. And there were just a few people in the session, and mental health was something that wasn't talked about a lot back then at APHA. And, you know, thanks to all the work of the mental health group and all, it's exciting to see, you know, more interaction between the two fields. So the first important thing that we had to do as an interagency work group, especially in the political atmosphere a few years ago, was we had to agree on certain principles to guide our screening. At that time on Capitol Hill, there was a lot of concern about mental health screening. And that's why I say it's very different than hearing or vision or any other kind of screening public health folks take for granted. Mental health screening, there were certain lobbying groups who felt that we were forcing medication on school students, that we were forcing universal screening, and that every student would be medicated. And you'll find throughout this, we have messages around the fact that early identification doesn't necessarily equal medication, and that there's a very thoughtful process to go through. And so you'll notice we were very, very planful in how we developed this guide. So the first thing was do no harm. Informed consent, that screening has to be a voluntary process, which may seem obvious to those of you in the public health field, but again, wasn't so much so in the mental health field. Need to be clear written procedures for the informed consent and made sure the parents, guardians, and other entities with legal custody of the youth. Juvenile justice had issues, and if you have questions, we can talk about that later. When you look at the guide, we very specifically included language that would fit all of our youth in all the different systems. Because not every youth has the traditional family, of course. We need to use valid and reliable screening instruments. We need to be developmentally, age, gender, and racially, ethnically, and culturally appropriate. Again, may seem like obvious things. However, when you look at the guide, you'll see there's really not many tools that are racially, ethnically, and culturally appropriate because they have not been tested yet, and that's a big need in the field still today. Respect and take into consideration the norms, language, and cultures, and be administered by qualified and appropriately trained personnel. And when Wendy talks more about the screening, you'll see that we really tried to make these tools accessible to not just substance abuse and mental health practitioners, but to families and to folks in the field in all these different areas, like child welfare, juvenile justice, homeless shelters, etc. And we also looked at how much training is involved, so that not all the tools take, master's degree or PhD trained background. Okay. Another big thing is that screening only identifies the possibility of a problem and should never be used to make a diagnosis or to label the child or adolescent. Critical, because we know the labeling is a huge issue, right? Confidentiality must be ensured. We fund what's called systems of care, which are grants across the country where they provide formal and informal supports and services to youth with mental health challenges. And when we go out and do a site visit, we really want to make sure those records are confidential. One of the things we look for. The other really critical ethical issue is a link to assessment and treatment. Many years ago, I worked at National Cancer Institute and dealt with breast cancer and other cancer issues. And, you know, years ago was a big issue that you don't screen women and then tell them there's no place to go if you find cancer, right? Same thing with this. It's not ethical to have no service and supports available if you're going to screen folks and give families and youth and children information they can't use. So there's definitely, in the guide, we really go through the process, and I think Wendy will go through some of that today. Talking about explaining the results so that the children, youth, and families understand what this means and what it doesn't mean, and then offering referral for appropriate in-depth assessment. In the next slide. Screening is not a diagnosis. We can't say that enough. There's a difference between assessment and screening. Those terms have been interchangeably used in the past, but screening tools are not, again, to produce a diagnosis. It indicates the presence of a potential problem that should receive a more detailed assessment. We know assessment is the really more intensive look and examination done by a mental health substance abuse professional. premature labeling of children and adolescents is counterproductive, and as I'm sure Erica will share with you, can be damaging. Okay. Okay.
Do you want that?
Yep, that's going to say. So this is, yeah, really, you're right, Angela. It's just repeating sort of what we said, that you want to make sure that they're linked with services after their screen. Thanks. If a child receives a diagnosis after an assessment by a qualified practitioner, both medication and therapy may be suitable interventions. Remember how I said at the beginning, a lot of people think that screening equals medication. Prescribed medication to treat a child or adolescent's mental health problem should be combined with other kinds of interventions for a comprehensive treatment plan. And in our systems of care, we actually include informal supports. What are the kinds of things that build on the youth's strength? Whether it's horseback riding or working on cars or, you know, can we provide funds so they can volunteer helping younger kids so they feel better about themselves? All of that is important, not just the medication. Now, we do psychotropic medication can be very, very helpful in some, you know, in certain situations. But it's not the primary form of mental health treatment for most children. Okay, when you look in the guide, we talk about the parents of teens surveyed at one local screening program, almost 90% of the teens were receiving therapy without any psychotropic medication. So opposite to the stereotype, we're not just screening and medicating. Okay, we're looking at the comprehensive needs of the child and youth if it's being done right, correct? And that's why, you know, there's a lot of controversy about primary care physicians putting kids on psychotropic medication, and that's why we often encourage to have a specialist to be doing that work, okay? And then we were going to talk about who's at higher risk. Well, there are some children and adolescents that do have a higher risk of developing mental health problems, substance abuse, or co-occurring. And in our field, co-occurring usually means mental health and substance use. Of course, it can also mean public health issues as well, medical problems. Some of the risk factors include having family members, living with conditions such as depression or other mental health disorders. Dr. Beardsley at Harvard has been doing a lot of work around that, and mothers experience depression. Approximately 13% of infants have mothers who suffer from postpartum depression, which can, not necessarily, but can impact the mother-child relationship, that ability to bond, and the child's development. Now, we are not in any way being negative toward the family members. It's a strength-based approach to say some family members may have mental health challenges or substance abuse challenges, then they need services and supports as well. We are not blaming the parents. That's critical. And I think, again, that Eric will emphasize that in the youth and family piece, that we do not blame families. Families, we look at in a very strength-based way. And I'm a family member myself, and I can say, I don't want any practitioners slamming me for the challenges my son is going through. We're all going through this journey together, and we need support just like our youth and children need support. We'll just go back 1 second, Angela. Thanks. Having developmental disabilities and chronic medical challenges can also impact, as you can imagine. Youth can experience depression when they have a really chronic illness. That's not surprising. So you need to look at both the physical and the mental health. And, you know, after all these years, many, many centuries ago, we were all very holistically inclined. And in the Western medical model, we've gotten away from that. It's only been really since the 70s, 80s, we begin to look at a holistic view of health. And that's, I think, SAMHSA, I'm happy to see, is getting closer to that, too, now, which is exciting. Also experiencing neglect, significant losses, poverty, a natural disaster. Just came from the Carter Center in Atlanta and had a very exciting two-day symposium on the impact of trauma, all these kinds of traumas on the brain of young children, their brains, and the impact throughout life and how they need to have trauma-informed care. As well as experiencing chronic violence at home or in the community or in schools. I need to go a little faster, okay. So thank you, Wendy, for keeping us on time. Finally, I want to really emphasize, as I mentioned, that working with families is a key partnership. You need to start with the families. And we know, especially for young children, but for all children and youth, their development occurs in the context of the relationships with whoever their key caregivers are, whether it's biological family, adopted family, foster family, guardians. And parent training can often be a very effective intervention. Parents and caregivers are the decision makers about their younger child's care. If their children are under 18, And here's one of our excellent partners from CDC, not to put her on the spot, but Ruth Perot, who was one of the authors of this. So isn't it great to walk in and you can feel like a movie star, Ruth? And Ruth, I was just mentioning the wonderful symposium we had at the Carter Center about the impact of trauma. And also, the parents and caregivers can be an excellent resource when you need to understand the whole situation. Use them as a resource and as a partner. Okay. So now, do we have any more time? Why don't we move to Eric's, and then if there are questions about financing, you'll see it in the guide. There are all kinds of resources to the financing piece, but I want to make sure that Eric gets his piece in because it's so critical. Thank you so much. Let's give Eric some space.
Sorry, guys.
We just have so much to share with you, but the guide, I think when it comes out, you'll
just think
find a wealth of information. Actually, 110 pages long, but you just need to look at the first four chapters and then the section. We try to make it usable, friendly, user-friendly.
All right, so I'm here to provide you guys a little bit of the youth perspective. My name is Eric Lula. I actually work as a Youth Involvement Associate for the National Federation of Families for Children's Mental Health and as a spokesperson for Youth Move National. On top of that, I serve on various different boards and councils and things like that, ensuring that the youth perspective is heard. And Lisa asked me to be here today, not because so much of my professional experience, but my personal experience. And I wanted to show you guys a couple of statistics that mean a great deal to me. The first one is the majority, 8% of youth involved in the child welfare system have developmental, emotional, behavioral problems, and less than a third of those young people actually receive services, and I fell into that category. Although coming through the child welfare system, facing abuse and neglect, drug exposure, I was actually given benzodiazepines as a child throughout most of my life until I turned about 8. And then another statistic that means a lot to me is a 2010 study of youth who aged out of the foster care system found that out of the 280 males that were studied, only about 1.5% obtained a four-year post-secondary education by the age of 24, and I also fell into that category. And if we move on to the next slide here, I'll actually tell you why I feel that I was able to achieve that small level of success. As I mentioned before, I experienced a lot of trauma in my early childhood. Lived with my mother. My mom and dad were divorced. My dad was incarcerated. Is actually currently serving a life sentence. My mother remarried. We moved in with my stepfather. It was a very abusive home. And spent 2 years there and actually was removed from that home because of the abuse and neglect that my sister and I were facing. And then we were placed into foster care. Through my journey through the foster care system, I was separated from all of my siblings. I've got 6 siblings. I was separated from all of them and ended up being adopted about 4 or 5 years later by my paternal grandparents. Unfortunately, that adoption actually failed after about 6 months. Once I was adopted, all the services stopped, so all the support stopped. The adoption failed. My grandparents felt they couldn't keep me in their home because of their medical reasons. And instead of putting me back into the foster care system, they actually moved me in with a relative and forwarded the adoption assistance to that relative. And when I turned 18, the money stopped, and I was asked to move out. And so I now found myself homeless, 18, obviously having experienced a whole slew of trauma and abandonment issues and all that kind of stuff. And through all of that, I was never diagnosed with anything. Never really had any kind of appropriate therapeutic intervention. I remember when I was in grade school, I did see a therapist. It was half an hour once a month, which wasn't really a whole lot, as you can imagine. But when I turned 18, I started going to college. I was actually working my way through college, and I believe I was in my first junior year of college. It took me 6 years to get through. But in my first junior year of college, I was taking a class and I was doing horribly. Like, my grades were really bad. I was barely scraping by with C's in most of my classes. And I was suffering from a lot of panic attacks, anxiety attacks, and things like that. And I didn't really know what to do, didn't really have access to any kind of health insurance, didn't really know how to deal with mental health issues because I had never been linked up with those services. And one day in class, I actually lost it. I was going to be honest with you guys. I completely lost it. I got a test back. I completely failed the test. I think I made like a 12 on it. It was horrible. And so I crumbled the test up, said a few choice words to my teacher as I was exiting the room by his class being a bunch of whatever. I won't say that in polite company now. But walked out. And then the next day, I went back to class because I did know that if I didn't continue going to classes that I would lose my student loans, which was my primary source of income at the time. So I went back to class, and my teacher called me up after the class was over and said, you know, can I talk to you for a minute? And I was like, sure. And I was saying to myself, just apologize to this man. He's going to rip into you, you know, like, you can't afford this, like, all that kind of stuff. And he looked at me, he's like, so what's going on? That was, like, my first screaming experience, was that moment right there. And they obviously didn't have a scientific tool to do it or anything like that. And my teacher asked a question that he probably wasn't expecting the answer that I gave him. Completely overwhelmed him. I told him about, like, my entire past, all of my issues with transition and things that I was going through, like the panic attacks and things that I was having. And he looked at me and he was like, well, I can't help you with that. He said, but there are people on campus who can. And he directed me to the Guidance Counseling Center. And he said that if you go and work with them, he's like, then I can work with you on this. And he actually pulled out my crumpled up test. And he said, I can, you know, tutor you during my free sessions and things like that. And so that was my first experience in my entire life in getting any kind of direction around mental health services. And so I went and got the screening. I was actually diagnosed with anxiety, depression, and PTSD. I mean, go figure. But if people equate screening to psychotropic medications, I can assure you that that was actually not the intervention that I received. Through effective counseling services, through getting back in touch with my peers and getting involved in more pro-social activities, I actually did not take any psychotropic medications during this time period. Once I started receiving those therapeutic interventions, things became a lot easier for me. I was able to focus more on school, and I actually switched from doing construction management to doing social work. Which, as you can imagine, doing social work, working in the field, brought up a lot of past trauma issues, but I've never had a negative experience as a result of that. And I think it was really because of this appropriate intervention and screening that I received. And so I wanted to put another statistic up there. In the previous study that I quoted, 95.5% of males who aged out of the foster care system didn't obtain their 2 or 4 year degree by the age of 24. I almost fell in to that statistic. And I feel that if this screening process, I put screening in quotes there because it's not an official screening tool, but if this screening process hadn't happened, I guarantee you I probably would have fell into that category. And I don't know where my life would be at this point if it wasn't for that. And so if you move on to the next slide from here. I wanted to throw up a couple other statistics there. Obviously, my experience was coming out of the foster care system, but I also had the experience of the adoption process, and I found another statistic that I fell into as well. 2007 study on adoption showed that 35% of families that are looking to adopt a young person actually back out of that adoption and said that one of the top reasons for this was youth mental, emotional needs and their foster care system involvement. So I can't help but wonder, you know, if like that was part of the reason that like my adoption didn't proceed and go through as planned. Another statistic that I didn't fall into, but very easily could have, and this is came from a Blueprint for Change from the juvenile justice system, a collaboration of individuals from the OJDDP got together and wrote this really extensive Blueprint for Change, and they cited in it, every youth who comes into contact with the juvenile justice system should be systematically screened for mental health needs to identify conditions and need an immediate response. It's definitely something that I agree with. So, the response that I got from the screening that I received definitely changed my life. And it did not put me on any kind of long-term medication. It just gave me the appropriate interventions and tools that I needed to manage my stress, manage my anxiety and depression, and to be able to overcome those obstacles that were placed on me. And so I really want to just encourage that we look and utilize this guide that's coming out and look at increasing the screening tools and areas where screening can happen for young people.
So, hi, I am not Peter Jensen. I'm very honored to be able to step in on his behalf, and I'm going to tell you some of the things that he put together. And because of time, I'm going to skip a few slides, and I'm going to focus in on some statistics that show you that Eric is more the rule than the exception in terms of having access to mental health treatment. About 15% of children and adolescents suffer from a mental illness that's severe enough that it affects their life. It impairs their development, their ability to work in school and so forth, and that it warrants treatment. But most don't get it, and the need is only expected to get greater. This is just an indication of some of the mental health diagnoses that can frequently arise in childhood. Next one. There are some special concerns in finding, assessing, and treating kids. They don't tend to seek help themselves. They have different signs and symptoms than adults. They often may experience more than one mental illness, which makes it confusing for people as to what's going on. They aren't necessarily good at expressing what's going on inside of them that would help give insight into there's something off. There's an absolute need to get information from multiple sources for this reason about how it is a kid behaving and functioning in the different domains in life. Treatments differ from those of adults, and there's much less research to inform those treatments. Skip the next one. This shows you the relative frequency of different common disorders in children. Basically, from 5 to 8% of youth have diagnosable disorders of that sort. So that's one benchmark. This gets into how does it affect a child to have a mental health condition. About 20% of kids have a mental health condition of some sort, but it doesn't necessarily really have a big impact on their functioning. They have anxiety or depression at a level that they can kind of manage and get by. But about 7% have a mental illness that affects them in either one of the domains of life, home, school, relationships, or their kind of inner sense of calmness and being okay. And then 5% are globally affected and have an illness so severe it affects all those domains. So it's that 5.4% that I'm going to focus on for the rest of this. You can skip that. There was a RAND study that mined multiple data sources because there's no single data source that really helps us to better understand need and access to service. And this shows how need varies across states. In the data that he had, and the message is just there's significant variation there from the average of 7% of they were using a measure of kind of mental health problems of a degree of significance that led the parents to feel that they would like to have treatment next. And then they looked at which kids were getting treatment, and about this is close to 2/3 of kids were not getting treatment. 2/3 of kids that had a significant mental health problem were not getting treatment, and this didn't vary between the teenagers and the younger kids. Next. But it did vary by insurance, with uninsured significantly less likely to get it, Medicaid being the best, but still more than half of kids with mental health problems in Medicaid not getting treatment. Minority kids less likely to get treatment, with Hispanics standing out as least likely. And then, again, significant between state variations in terms of unmet need for kids. And the author of this report, Stern, pointed out that, you know, basically, you have a kid with a mental health problem, it makes a big difference what state they live in as to whether they're likely to get the care they need. Next. So we can skip that one. That just summarizes what we've seen. So then there was another study, and this one Peter Jensen has been actively involved in. And this one was to look at that 5% of kids with global impairment and try and learn about what was their case? Were they getting services? Where were they? And so they used a combination of working with physicians, researchers, and family members to identify conditions of concern. So next slide. These are 11 action signs they developed consensus on. Symptoms, not diagnoses, because these symptoms could be related to one or more diagnoses, but symptoms that in and of themselves were serious enough that they would warrant seeking treatment and attention for a child. So suicidality with a recent attempt or a plan. No brainer. Yeah, that's serious. Hyperactivity to the degree it results in physical danger. There. Serious. No brainer. Let's get it. So here's this list of, with a high degree of consensus, that are important. Next slide. So then they went and mined existing epidemiological studies to determine of kids that had those symptoms, were they getting treatment? And here you see, by parent report, those with severe depression, well, more than 50%, less than 60% were failing to get services. So they're doing a little bit better than that two-thirds average that the Sturm study found. But the rest are doing worse. Those that are extremely hyperactive, they're up above 60% at about the average for all kids. A suicide attempt, they're up above 70%. 75% of kids with a suicide attempt not getting a mental health service in the past year. Extreme aggression, even worse. That's just a bad behavior. And parents reported no use of vomitive or laxatives among normal weight children. They were not aware of them. So then we look at what the youth informants had to say. They certainly reported a lot of use of vomiting or laxatives that the parents clearly were not aware of, and their rates of not getting treatment were higher. So here you have a really egregious situation where most kids with the most severe, totally, you know, the people would agree upon were significant problems, not getting services in the past year. Okay, we can skip that then. So how are we going to address this? And one place is primary care. Currently 3 to 4 kids in primary care don't have their mental health problems identified there. There's a clear consensus from the Surgeon General, all sorts of groups, that children in primary care, in school, in foster care, in juvenile justice need mental health to be involved in their checkups, and brief screening tools used by physicians and other parties can easily increase the level of identification. Next slide. States can EPSDT programs, early and periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment, can set standards for physicians' well child care that has to include behavioral health screening that's age appropriate. That can be done by screening tools. Many states have started to take advantage of this. In Massachusetts, I think we're up to 80% of kids having a behavioral health screen now, but many states do not. There are a whole set of valid tools that are available. Those that are underlined have been tested in primary care settings. We have a list of these in the screening guide that will be coming out. There are some that are comprehensive, inclusive, deal with a range of mental health problems that might arise at a particular age, and others that are specialized and look at a specific diagnosis. And the other thing is to go back to the action signs work. There's a toolkit for the action signs. There's a poster designed to be put up in physicians' offices, in schools, of the action signs to help increase the general mental health literacy out there, help train people that, you know, parents, that if this has happened to their kid, they should bring it up with the PCC, train the PCCs to be asking about it. Staff in child serving programs need to be aware. So that it's all been vetted to be kind of user-friendly for non-professionals, and a lot of work has gone into that, and it's available from the website of the REACH Institute. So let's move on. And just how do we bring it into the system? One thing is there could be contractual requirements, can measure the use of validated screening tools in primary care, either, you know, put penalties or incentives onto that, work for co-location to make mental health care more accessible, use feedback and automated systems to help people keep track of who's been screened and what the results were. So basically, Peter's message is, you know, the need is absolutely clear. It couldn't be more overwhelming, and it's just time to take the leap and find these kids.